Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the impact of the Trump administration's mass deportation efforts on migrant children, and a cultural reclamation project in the far northwest corner of the state. But first, speaking of culture, a few years ago, the sketch comedy show Portlandia did a very funny bit about how the city of Portland, Oregon, was a little bit stuck in the past.
Do you remember the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about getting piercings and getting tribal tattoos.
Yeah.
And people are singing about saving the planet and forming bands.
Yeah.
There's a place where that idea still exists as a reality, and I've been there.
Where is it?
Portland.
Oregon?
Yeah.
These days, it feels like the dream of the 90s is alive and well all over the country, with the resurgence of things like bucket hats and baggy jeans, TV shows like Friends and The West Wing, reinvigorated careers for stars like Parker Posey, Winona Ryder, Brendan Fraser. So what is behind this burst of nostalgia for the end of the 20th century? On today's Culture Cap, we will explore that very question. I am joined in studio by the show's resident pop culture expert, Amanda Kerberg, a PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning.
And we are also joined today by creative director of the YouTube series Space for Humans, part of ASU's Interplanetary Initiative, Mr. Ricardo Leon. Ricardo, good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So I just mentioned some examples of 90s nostalgia that we're seeing around the culture. Where would both of you say we're seeing this crop up the most? What are some more notable examples? Amanda, let's start with you.
I would say, yeah, in terms of fashion, some other elements would be things like the kind of ugly sneaker resurgence.
Ooh.
We've also got tiny backpacks coming back.
Yes.
Windbreakers. Oh, my gosh. Every time I see a friend out in a windbreaker, like the number of compliments that she's getting. Because we're just all like so excited to see them. In terms of television, reboots. Blockbuster reboots, like you said, yeah, careers for resurgences for people like Brendan Fraser, Christina Ricci. We're just seeing the Buffy the Vampire Slayer reboot getting kind of ramped up.
That's
like we
right.
just got our new savior of of humanity against the vampires. So there's just so much in media. And yeah, Friends, I think, is maybe the quintessential example of like when I talk to my students about what they're watching on TV, I expect it to be like this really, really new cultural stuff. And instead, so often it'll be like TikTok and Friends over and over and over again.
Wow.
And yeah, it's not even the reboot of Friends. It's
no,
the original episodes
the
original of
Friends. Friends.
Yes. And we're seeing a crop of shows, if I'm not mistaken now, that are designed to kind of be the Gen Z version of Friends.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When it seems like what Gen Z actually wants is just Friends.
Friends.
They're very lonely, Sam.
Yes. Ricardo, what about for you? What are some notable examples?
Oh, the way I think of it, there's a few things that I think of that are kind of sourced in the 90s, had their big moments in the 90s that are still pretty, that just haven't left our screens. You know, we have a Jurassic Park movie coming out this summer, and that's just, but there have been Jurassic Park movies consistently since the original came out.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. I if I'm not mistaken, there was a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I guess we called it a reboot.
Right.
Recently.
Yeah.
But that seems like another example to me of something that started in the 90s.
Right.
Or maybe even the late 80s.
Right.
And it's just stayed with us.
Yeah. It just never goes away.
Yeah. Yeah. We love all of those. I mean, even like the Barbie movie, I would argue, was so much about like us, our generation growing up in the 90s playing with Barbies, playing with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So like the reboots are such a callback to these really, really happy times in our lives. But like, as you guys mentioned, in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie, we had a song from A Tribe Called Quest.
Right? Yes, sure, sure. That was heavily involved in the promotion of the movie.
Yeah. Can I Kick It?
Yes. Can I Kick It? Yeah. And then Barbie, of course, had them huddled around campfires listening to the Kens all sing Push.
Smashbox 20, yeah.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm also interested to get both of your perspectives on kind of the counterfactual here. Where are we not seeing resurgence of 90s culture that's interesting to you? This is a very personal example for me, but I have been really hoping that this kind of 90s rebirth moment would be an opportunity to share my love for the Dave Matthews Band with a new generation of listeners. That's me coming out on the radio as a Dave Matthews Band fan.
Yeah, yeah. All you ants continue marching.
Yes, yes. But I feel like, you know, that group, which was such a big part of 90s culture in my mind, hasn't really caught the wave in the same way as some of these other things.
Well, last summer I went to a big concert, and it was Weezer and Third Eye Blind. And I think that that's just that cycle that things go through, that those become the oldies. You know, that's like my dad going to Cheap Trick or something like that.
Right.
You know, so, and I think that
I think there is, I mean, there's a certain argument that the reason that we get these kinds of cyclical nostalgia moments are that that generation that had like peak culture that they had in their like tweens and teenage years then get spending power 20 years down the line.
Right.
And
then all of a sudden they're ready for these kinds of concerts and stuff. Yeah.
Well, Sarah Michelle Gellar is now at the age where she can have a vampire slayer daughter who's at that age that she was when she was in the original.
Right.
I don't know. You know what? If I had to pick things that haven't really come back fully that I would like back, maybe that kind of invisible wrap technology, you know, like all the kind of cute candy Mac products and stuff.
Oh,
and
like, wow.
I want to look at all the interior in like outlandish colors again.
Yes. Clear things was a big thing in the 90s.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Crystal Pepsi now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. It worked out less well for them, but
yeah. Good things. Good that some things have not stayed with us.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Amanda, I think you had mentioned in a conversation that we had that we used to kind of gauge our week by what was on television, gauge our days by what was on television. And now we're free to watch and consume whatever we want at any time of day.
Yes, I want, you know what, Sam, that is the real answer to what I want back. I want constraints.
Right.
I want constraints. I was just
less
thinking
choice
today. Yes, I think maybe one of the genius elements that I've never considered of Baskin-Robbins saying they have 31 flavors is not that it's a lot of flavors, but that it's a finite amount of flavors. I get on streaming and I'm overwhelmed. And then I'll end up like the other night I was trying to find a TV show or a movie to watch. And instead I just watched Patti LuPone singing Don't Cry For Me, Argentina in like the 70s, like just over and over again.
Right. Isn't that interesting? I mean, Baskin-Robbins is such an example of this brand that was defined by its limitations.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is too big of a leap, but that also makes me think of, Amanda, you and I have talked before, and it feels relevant here, about the experience of going to Blockbuster Video.
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be Blockbuster. It could just be any kind of brick-and-mortar video store, which was also an experience that was defined by limitation.
Yeah.
There was this idea that there are these recognized places where you can go to have a certain kind of experience that will be boundaried in a certain way. And in some ways, I think that made those experiences more intense because you were like, I only have a limited range of choices that I can make.
Yeah.
And I'm going to engage with these things very deeply.
Oh, I loved that so much. I mean, it's the same with the TV thing. Like, I know I talk a lot about Sunday night HBO as like this bounded ritual that in some ways is a little bit of an echo of kind of the monoculture we had in the 90s. But we really grew up with that of just TGIF. That's when we're all in front of the TV watching these shows. Saturday morning cartoons. Like, so even as we have this kind of cultural discussion about the idea that we're losing community and we don't have these kinds of like shared third spaces anymore, in a way, we had shared third spaces apart, at least, because right. we were all looking at our screens at the same time.
Yes, yes. Well, and there was a way in which you would talk about, you would come into school on Monday or come into work on Monday, and you would talk about the cultural experiences that you had, the music you'd listen yes. to, the movies you watched.
The water cooler effect.
Exactly. Yes. Because you couldn't talk about them on social media all weekend long.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yes,
you weren't
right.
connected
yeah.
in the same way.
Yeah, yeah. My friend Angela always talks about when she was in elementary school, everybody came into school like that following Monday and they had all learned the Urkel dance from Family Matters. And they were like doing it in the hallways. And she was like, how did you pick this up this fast? These are hard choreographs. Like, yes. this is not easy choreography.
Like, you've just awakened a core memory in me of a similar moment from Beavis and Butthead that we probably can't talk about on the radio.
Right.
But yes, that was a similar thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the options that we had. It was the options in sharing those experiences with other people.
Yes.
We were more boundaried.
Yeah. Right. If you're right. thinking like the water cooler moment, you know, I always think like my idea of the water cooler now is maybe the Zoom waiting room. And the amount of saturation, and like publicists are talking about this now, the amount of saturation you have to get in culture to have something that people all can talk about in that Zoom waiting room is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you don't just need advertising. You need like this complex media mix that is like Evan Ross Katz doing memes on
right.
Instagram.
Yeah.
You need like thirst trap TikTok. You need, you know, multiple podcasts that are about eating chicken with someone.
Like, yeah.
So complicated to reach that moment where you get the water cooler effect. That's mm-hmm. hard.
And a moment ago, we were talking about this phenomenon of cultural boundaries that used to exist that arguably enriched a lot of our cultural engagement with some of these things that we were talking about, whether it was television shows or music. And that makes me want to ask, and Ricardo, let's start with you for this one. Do you think there is something different about 1990s nostalgia? Because obviously we see nostalgia booms for lots of decades. 60s, 70s, 80s culture have all kind of had their moment of resurgence. What for you is different about the way we're re-experiencing the 90s?
You know, in the 90s, there were, in the 80s as well, but there was a big push towards the 60s nostalgia, I think. There was the mm-hmm. Wonder Years, there was Stand By Me,
yeah.
and there was this feeling that the past was so different than it is now. And somehow, I feel like the 90s doesn't feel that different from where we are today. I mean, of course, we can look at fashion, a few things are different, but really, I feel like, you know, we had the internet. We had the beginnings of the internet.
Yep.
We had, 24-hour cable news at that time as well. I don't know that it feels as different as it felt in the 60s, where things just seem radically different from the way things were in the 90s.
That's very interesting. There is a media sense, I think,
mm-hmm.
in which our re-experiencing of the 60s or maybe the 70s, when we were coming of age in the 90s, was mediated more significantly by, you know, grainy footage of Woodstock, like
right.
old, you know, radio recordings of certain kinds of music. Whereas in the 90s, we're already in the era, as you mentioned, of the internet, the personal computer, the era of the screen. So there's this way in which reality felt more present, though it was still, of course, mediated. That gap maybe wasn't as significant. Amanda, would you agree?
Yes. No, I think that's a really important point. And I mean, that begs the question of what future nostalgia is going to look like as we have more and more content. So there's less that you're bringing to the nostalgia of your imagination, which I think means in some ways there's less opportunity to over-aggrandize the idea of this lost era, because these nostalgic moments that we have do kind of follow this pattern where we long for something that's more authentic, maybe slower, but again, yeah, quintessentially different. But it being different also involves the idea that there's a lot of it that you maybe don't have archived. And so you're filling in gaps. And
yeah.
and mm-hmm. with the 90s, we have so many TV show recaps that are like the 90s with YouTube videos. There's so much more of it that's recorded in quality. And so as we get nostalgic for times that had social media, my goodness, I mean, that's going to look very different. But yeah, I think for me, also one of the eras we were real nostalgic for in the 90s was the 70s. And it followed that very same pattern of we're nostalgic, and this applies to the 60s as well for these moments of kind of really true countercultural movements mm-hmm. that felt more authentic and felt more grounded in really pushing against, you know, power structures. And I think the 90s, when we're looking back on it now, we are looking back at these kinds of countercultural movements too. But what was different about the 90s is that that was really the beginning of kind of subsuming counterculture into commercialized
yes.
culture and mainstreaming. I mean, mainstreaming hip hop music, mainstreaming like emo, mainstreaming mm-hmm. punk,
yeah.
mainstreaming grunge, like just in it here. We're selling it to you at Target now.
Right, right. You know, you're also making me think as you're saying that there perhaps was a way in which the advent, Ricardo, you were mentioning cable news coming onto the scene in the mm-hmm. 90s. We've talked about the internet. MTV is also such a phenomenon of the 90s.
Right.
Absolutely.
And there e-entertainment television, Court TV, these kind of always on steady stream of stimuli. Obviously, you know, this is before the time of YouTube, before the time of TikTok and things that we kind of take for granted now. But perhaps there was a way in which the 90s was training us to be 2025 media consumers, because the switch to always on entertainment arguably was sort of flipped.
Right.
Yes.
On screens, at least.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think absolutely we are getting this sense of like you're never leaving media. Media is always always in some way a part of your life. Becomes the case more and more and more. I you know the famous public service announcement. That spoke to kind of the way Gen X was raised, that it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your kids are? Like, we make fun of that, but that's because they didn't know where their kids were.
Right. And they had no way of finding out.
And they needed the TV to remind them. But by the time you get 90s kids like us, it's like you knew where we were because the TV was watching us.
Yeah, we were watching TGIF. Yeah. Parked.
Yeah. So
sorry.
No, go ahead.
Something that changed in the 90s was the advent of technologies that are tied to personal media. Mm-hmm. So we look at, you know, someone documenting Woodstock. That was a large production crew documenting that. But now in the 90s, you have personal camcorders that you can document every part of your life.
Right.
You know, and anyone can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they submit it to America's Funniest Home Videos and they yes. make $1 million off of it.
Yes. Kind of the proto version of user generated content. Right.
Right.
Oh,
right.
That's
absolutely.
So true. And even like user consumed content too, like Walkmans, like being mm-hmm. in public spaces, just consuming content by yourself too. That really gets off. Yeah. In the 90s. Yeah.
That's another interesting example. I think the Walkman, the Discman of that thing we were talking about, the sort of blockbuster phenomenon of like a boundaried, or maybe the Baskin Robbins phenomenon, a boundaried experience with something that is also very personal and arguably because of that more intense. And, you know, now we're in a world where it's a personal experience and there's no limit to what you can listen to or watch.
Right.
But again, we were sort of trained by this 1990s moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I do think there's a lot, speaking of because, that point about kind of user-generated and, like, home media making it so important. But I think there's also a lot that's happening in the 90s with MTV as well that is preparing us for the idea that the content of everyday people is going to be consumed for, like, the masses. So, like, this kind of breakdown of public versus private that we see with, like, the Real World and the kinds of conversations they're having on the Real World. About, you know, diversity and sexuality and like very personal matters that all of a sudden are being fed to, you know, wide audiences, but especially kids growing up.
Yeah. And,
but again, the idea that reality television is just kind of beginning to form and the idea that everyday people's personal lives could be something for public consumption, that we could also be the product. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we just have about a minute left here, and I want to ask you both. Amanda, you were mentioning earlier this idea that the 90s were like kind of a last good time for a lot of people of a certain age. People may be figuring out that's the age of the three of us who are having this conversation.
It's all downhill from there, folks.
But as you look ahead, and we kind of predict the fact that early 2000s nostalgia is probably somewhere out there in the offing, what do you think, for both of you, we'll start with you, Amanda, are some of the elements of that period of time that are likely to resonate?
I think that's such an interesting one. I'm because there is a lot of overlap, I think, between the late 90s and kind of the early 2000s. And of course, then what begins to happen in the early 2000s that kind of shapes this push against countercultural movements and this kind of reinforcement of patriotism. And but at the same time, you have an internet that has grown up enough to the point where people can really start to participate, create their own websites, you know, create their own MySpace pages. But before we get this heavily, heavily commercialized, like kind of, you know, sanitized version of social media that we have now. So we have the sense of the internet as this really fun playground, but we don't feel like so constrained yet. I think there's this moment in the 2000s that really captures this kind of pre-overwhelming smartphone, you know, always connected, always doom scrolling kind of moment where the internet still had a lot of hope in it, I think.
Right.
And then at the same time, yeah, I think maybe a nostalgia for the early 2000s will be like the last time where we really see radical fashion changes, because fashion has become in a lot of ways kind of like kind of a consistent thread. Like,
yeah,
when you look back at the 2010s, people don't look that different. But if you look back at the 2000s, you have those like going out tops and peplum and oof.
Ricardo, what about you?
I mean, I think in some ways we're already seeing it. You know, we look at some of the programs from 2000s that were on MTV, Jackass and the Tom Green Show, and that same, you know, attitude, that kind of anarchic attitude of being just ridiculous and conveying a sense of fun. But we're seeing that all over TikTok and all of our social media platforms. I think that the era of the idiot is going to I predict that. That's my prediction for our next nostalgia cycle.
Well, what year did Green Day's American Idiot come out? I think it was like 2002, 2003,
yeah.
Right?
That's so good. Yeah. A shout out to Mr. Beast, who just became the youngest self-made billionaire.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, we'll have another culture cap to talk about that. I have been speaking with Amanda Kerberg, PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism, and Ricardo León, creative director of the YouTube series Space for Humans. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a small town on the border of Arizona and Utah is trying to escape its sordid past by rebranding as a tourist destination. But first, President Trump campaigned on the idea of mass deportations. In fact, he promised the biggest mass deportation in U.S. history. The actual numbers of people removed from the country are a bit tricky to come by. NBC News' deportation tracker reports more than 48,000 migrants in ICE detention as of last Friday. The outlet also reports Immigration and Customs Enforcement deported a little more than 12,000 people in March. ICE's official dashboard, is only current as of January. There have also been a number of legal challenges to the Trump administration's deportation policies and concerns about what happens to the children of migrants who are kicked out of the country. That is the space in which our next guest works. Kelly Albanac Cribbs is an attorney at the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, a national nonprofit. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked her how her workload has changed over the past several months.
Yeah, I mean, there's never been a shortage of work for immigrant advocates defending the rights of kids and families, but the extraordinary increase in need that we've seen over the last few months, at the same time that we've seen organizations and attorneys doing this work come under attack by the Trump administration, it's just made the workload for these organizations just incredibly high right now. It's been an unprecedented era.
Have you noticed a change in the types of cases that you're getting, or any, you know, sort of any trends about like how these cases are unfolding, or is it still pretty much what you've been doing in the past, just more of it?
Well, what's undeniable is that under this administration, there's been an incredible uptick in immigration enforcement actions, right? People being detained and deported in ways that we hadn't seen in recent years, right? So we are seeing a need for legal services support for immigrant families in situations that hadn't maybe presented the same type of need before this administration. So folks who might have otherwise been able to go about their lives in the community with their families, working their jobs while their cases were pending, are now being detained and in some instances deported really quickly.
So what are you seeing for parents who are detained and perhaps ultimately deported? It seems like they have a few options of maybe what they can do with their kids, depending on maybe arrangements that have been made prior to their detention.
I mean, certainly the kind of best practice information right out there right now for families is it's wise to be making a plan in advance of any sort of crisis, right? So you see a lot of legal aid organizations like the Young Center and others advising families to have an action plan if a parent or a caregiver for a child is detained, to ideally have some legal documentation formalizing that plan in place so that if a parent or caregiver is deported, there's somebody in the United States who has the legal authority to continue caring for a child. But I think that what we are seeing in a lot of these instances is just such extraordinary immigration enforcement action that a lot of families are left without much of an opportunity to actually plan for children's care and custody. And it results in family separation that in some instances could be permanent.
Yeah. So what kinds of things are you able to do in those cases if parents haven't made arrangement for what to do with their U.S. citizen kids? And we should specify these are specifically kids who are born here who are U.S. citizens. Like, what are you able to do? What are the options for what happens to those kids?
I mean, in the ideal scenario, a detained parent, and whether their child is a U.S. citizen or not, frankly, but ideally that parent has an opportunity to consult with other family members to make a plan for the care of their child, to determine whether they want their child to remain here in the United States or to be removed with them, and then to see that plan put into action. But in reality, that's just not what we're seeing. We're seeing parents who maybe want to take a child with them because they don't want to be separated, not being allowed to do that. Or in other instances, you know, as we just saw out of Louisiana a few weeks ago, parents of U.S. citizen children, they wanted to remain in the United States, but they didn't have that opportunity. They were cut off from communicating with family and with their attorneys and were ultimately removed with their U.S. citizen children.
So what happens to kids in the case where a parent is deported, but the child stays in the U.S.? Let's say they maybe don't have a family member or a designated caregiver that they can go to. Like, what happens to those kids?
Yeah, that's a great question. When a child remains here after a parent's deportation and there isn't another family member to step up and care for that child, what we can see is the child taken into the state child welfare custody or the foster care system in the state that they live in. And that can kick off a very long process of a state court that is really only accustomed to dealing with U.S. citizen children generally, who have U.S. citizen parents, you know, to a state court evaluating whether that child can be reunified with their parent or whether that parent's rights should be permanently severed and the child should be up for adoption.
What are you hearing from some of these kids? I mean, I can only imagine the trauma of having a parent detained and deported and maybe not know if you're going to see them again. Depending on the age of the kid, if they're old enough to understand that, but then if they're young enough to maybe not really have any idea what's going on.
You know, Mark, in thinking about how to answer that question, I am reminded of what I bore witness to back in 2017 and 2018 when I and many of my colleagues at the Young Center and in the immigrant advocacy community were on the front lines of the family separation crisis, where we saw the first Trump administration very intentionally separating children from parents at the border. And the trauma that we bore witness to, you know, that the kids experienced and that the parents experienced as well, it had a profound impact. You know, there's many of these families I'm still in touch with to this day. They're still recovering from the harm of the separation that they experienced 7-8 years ago. It continues to ripple through their lives. And it's not something that goes away easily. So I look at what is unfolding around us right now in this day and age, and it's essentially the same thing. It's family separation on a wide scale. It's just not getting the same attention that it did back in 2018.
Do you think there's a better way to do this? That, like, if the government's goal is to remove people from the U.S. who are not citizens of this country, who are here undocumented, is there a better way to make that happen with not causing the kind of trauma to kids that this policy seems to be causing?
Well, the first way it has to happen is in compliance with basic principles of due process, right? That's one of the biggest concerns that immigrant advocates are raising right now, is that folks are being detained and deported without their day in court, without an opportunity to show that they might be eligible for some type of status that means they don't have to be deported in the first place. But even after you go through a court process that is grounded in due process, if an individual cannot show that they have the right to remain here and they're facing deportation, there are absolutely child and family friendly policies that could be put in place to help ensure that any deportation that does take place has a minimally traumatic impact on a family. Now, don't get me wrong, it's always going to be traumatic for a family to lose somebody as they're deported, but there are things that we can do to help the family prepare for that and to mitigate the harm of that act of family separation.
What kinds of things do you think in a perfect world, again, if this kind of policy is the policy the government is going to pursue, what kinds of things do you think should be happening to help these kids?
Ample opportunity for parents and legal guardians to be able to communicate with other family members when they're detained to make a plan for the care and custody for their children. If they want to take their children with them, ICE should be facilitating that when they make that request. If they want to their kids to remain here in the United States, there might be legal documentation that they need to put in place before to help ensure that their child has a legal guardian. They shouldn't be deported before that paperwork is completed. They should have ongoing communication and visitation with their children the entire time that they are detained without impediment. There are a lot of different steps that we could take to try to make this less harmful than it inevitably is.
All right. That is Kelly Albanac-Cribbs, an attorney with the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights. Kelly, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Today, we're sharing an essay from last year's Soapbox series on the topic of summer camp. Here is Tempe writer and performer Kim Porter with a story of drama, games, and friendship.
Creative envy is my driving force. No matter what artistic activity I'm currently doing, if I see someone somewhere doing some other artistic activity, I'll immediately feel sorry for myself. Why can't I do that? Nobody triggers that envy more than Jasper Starfire. I met Jasper in 1994 when I ran the costume shop at Camp Winter Rainbow, a circus camp in the woods of Northern California. Jasper taught drama and art. Every day I'd stand in the costume barn peering over the rack of clown suits as Jasper improvised for the kids. He was tall with floppy blonde hair, a booming laugh, and a Tom Hanksian charm. I wanted to be Jasper, or at least be like him. I was reacquainted with Jasper in 2013 when I returned to camp after a 17-year hiatus. He was old now, like me, married with kids of his own, but somehow even more enviable. Jasper walked through camp like a visiting prince, an entourage of 10-year-olds tugging at his sleeves. I get it. When Jasper shines his attention on you, it feels like you've been invited to the ball. Once, while walking up the dirt road to the kitchen, I came upon him, wearing a name tag that read Listening Tour. I said, "Why are you on a listening tour?" He pulled out a notepad and he wrote, "Laryngitis." I said, "How do you do that? How do you always find the game?" And he wrote, "If you can't fix it, feature it." Why can't I figure out how to feature envy? Over the years, I cultivated a friendship with Jasper. We were both early risers, and we'd meet at the kitchen to supervise the campers as they played board games before breakfast. One morning, as Jasper and I sat sipping coffee, I noticed two girls playing the game Who's Who, and I got excited. Who's Who is a game for two players in which each player tries to guess the other player's mystery person by asking only yes or no questions. Each player has a plastic tray with about 20 tiny hinged frames. Inside of each frame is a cartoon face. There's an additional deck of cards with all the same faces, and the players draw a card from that deck and they keep it secret. When it's your turn, you can ask questions like, is your person a man? Is he wearing a hat? Does he have a mustache? And if your opponent says no, then you flip down all the frames with all the men who do have hats and mustaches. Thus, turn by turn, you eliminate the wrong faces until you have just one face left. I said to Jasper, I like to play that game, but instead of asking things you can see, I like to ask things you can only feel, like, has your person been to France, or are they scared of dogs? Jasper looked intrigued. Can you guess the right person doing that? No, it never works. I'd like to try that, he said. I felt elated. Jasper liked my idea. On the last morning of camp, as Jasper and I were cleaning up the games while the kids headed to breakfast, I said, want to play Who's Who? He said, sure. I was thrilled, but scared. What if I'd oversold it? We each drew our secret person from the deck. I drew Frank. Is your person late with their child support payments? I asked. No. I flipped down the guys who seemed like they might be late with their child support. Jasper asked, do they live in their mom's basement? Not anymore. Jasper flipped a few frames. I asked, do they call their mom mother? We played like this for about 15 minutes with a mounting sense of urgency, seeing as we were actively shirking our supervisory duties. Are they allergic to eggs? Do they hoard cats? Are they writing a novel? I got down to one remaining face. Here goes, I thought. Is your person Victor? Jasper's eyes flashed as she showed me his card. Victor. Neither of us could believe that I'd guessed correctly. It felt like a miracle. Jasper said, was your person Frank? I showed Jasper my card. Frank. Tears of joy stung my eyes. To look into Jasper's face, knowing that something ridiculous and sublime, a perfect once-in-a-lifetime moment, had transpired between us, was perhaps the greatest victory of my life. I am like Jasper after all. But more importantly, Jasper is like me. Today we left it all, we
look beyond the veil. That was writer and performer Kim Porter. Check out more summer camp stories at KJZZ.org. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Way up in the northwest corner of Arizona sits a tiny town with a somewhat confusing name, Colorado City. Even more confusing, the town is so close to the border that all you have to do is basically cross the street and you're in Utah. When you do that, the name of the town switches too, to Hilldale. Together, these two towns are sometimes referred to as Short Creek, and they are united by a tormented history. The community was home to the extremist FLDS religious sect ruled by Warren Jeffs, who is currently serving a life sentence in prison for his role in the systematic sexual assault of many of the women in Short Creek. In Short Creek slash Colorado City slash Hilldale, the residents who still live there are trying in various ways to move on from the horrors of the Jeffs era. In some cases, that means rebranding the town as a tourist destination. Last week, I spoke with Phoenix Magazine editor Craig Outier, who visited the region recently to profile some of the people who are part of that effort, like Shane Took.
Shane was a hairdresser. He and his wife owned a bunch of salons in neighboring St. George. He found this land. It was owned by Warren Jeffs, who apparently, among his many other paradoxes, enjoyed making wine. And he had this
which,
little vineyard.
Which, to be clear, he did not approve of his flock consuming.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. Apparently, alcohol wasn't as verboten as it is in mainstream Mormonism.
Oh, okay.
And but he did it on the sly behind this compound in these walls, made wine. So Shane, he saw that it was vineyards. The real estate agent who showed it to him didn't know what they were. He's like, ooh, this is fun. You know, picked some grapes, analyzed them, found out what he had there in terms of varietals, and started making, teaching himself wine, natural winemaking.
That's got to be a one in a million shot for a real estate transaction, yes, where you're standing there and then you've this basically garden has been marketed to you as like, you could probably pick this up for pretty cheap.
Right.
And you're standing there and you realize you're standing on a potential gold mine.
Yeah, right. And a lifestyle change. You know, that's what they do now. They own a cool little B&B on site. It's an event space. They have weddings. They build a really beautiful tasting room. I mean, the place is lovely. And I think really emblematic of what's happening in Colorado City and Hilldale. It's very different.
Can I ask you, you brought up the walls and fences a moment ago. Can you talk a little bit more about what those look like? Because people might be imagining just like, you know, fences like you would see around a yard. But
right,
that's not what we're talking about.
No, we're talking about, in some cases, 10-foot concrete walls that you might imagine surrounded a compound that, say, Osama bin Laden holed away in Pakistan. I mean, these are designed to keep people in and out. Mayor Jessup told me that a lot of them were torn down and that it's much better than it was before. And she made the point that a lot of the fences and walls were added during the height of media attention, not to keep, you know, pluralistic wives or girls in, but really to keep prying eyes away because they didn't feel like they had any privacy.
Let's talk about Mayor Jessup for a moment, because she's a pretty fascinating figure and she plays a big role in your piece.
Yeah.
She's somebody who had to deal with some of the harshest realities of the Jeffs, I'm going to use the word regime.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, might as well.
Yeah. maybe that's too tame of a word.
Yeah, right.
And yet, loved the place so much that,
right,
you know, she came back and now she's the mayor. And she has a pretty interesting relationship with the place's past, is sort of live and let live, right? Is that a fair way of characterizing it?
I mean, she doesn't want to demonize people who there in town who are kind of trying to capitalize off of the history. I mean, there is sort of a true crime tour energy going on there with, you know, there's a B&B that is situated in the compound that the residents built for Warren Jeffs. Someone took it over and they turned it into a nice hotel, mm-hmm, you know, Zion's Most Wanted, they call it.
Right. Because Jeffs referred to himself as the most wanted man in Utah,
yeah,
or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So she isn't like that. She wants to look forward. She wants to, you know, when she's rebranding this place, she wants to talk about the beauty of it and the love and the commitment of the residents to each other, not necessarily the past.
I was sort of alluding to the fact that Danya had dealt with some of the worst parts of the Jeff's time controlling the area.
Right.
What did that look like for her?
Well, she was a part of a prominent family there. She and her husband got married without the blessing, official blessing, of the leaders of the church. I think she was one of the most vocal dissidents. And eventually, she and her family were all excommunicated. But even that wasn't clean. Like, they tried to keep one of her daughters. I mean, disgusting. But it didn't take long after she left for the state to step in, and she did come back, and she's part of a new wave of returnees. I mean, it really is like the biblical Zion, where you have this, you know, this diaspora, and now they're all coming back.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be a really fascinating headspace to be in, to have been cast out of this place that you think of as your home, and now to come back, and as you were alluding to earlier, be an instrumental part of trying to look ahead. Another person who seems to be living that journey is Shem Fisher, whose home was basically commandeered by the Jeffs family.
Yeah,
right?
Well, that's the way it, tenant at will, in quotation marks, right, I believe is the legal mechanism you can use to evict someone from their own home when the entire town is owned in trust by a single entity, the church. So he was one of roughly 40 children, tons of kids. His father was an avowed polygamist who moved from Salt Lake with the family, raised the whole brood. And, you know, Shem was not a polygamist. He didn't really care for that. He was always sort of an outsider and had a prosperous company that he ran with his father, who loved and admired. He just didn't, you know, emulate him on that level in terms of marrying multiple women. They ran a cabinet shop, very prosperous. But when Jeffs took over and told all of the residents that they couldn't hire or work with apostates, a lot of those people were his employees and friends. He objected to that. He thought it was religiously discriminating on a lot of levels. He just found it abhorrent. And then he was excommunicated and banished. And they took this essentially a mansion, really, and Jeff's brother lived in it.
Right.
And so when finally the state stepped in and they reclaimed all this property, he was, of course, first in line to get his home back. He did. He put a lot more money into it. They kind of trashed the place. And now he runs it as an awesome guest lodge, you know, with five beers on tap, great little breakfast kitchen.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other little details from that standpoint that was really interesting to me is I didn't realize that Utah, I guess, has a limit on the percentage of alcohol in beverages.
Beers. Yeah,
in beers. Right. Okay.
Specifically beers on tap.
Beers on
5%.
Tap. 5%.
I just got back from Utah, so I'm well versed now in this odd little law they have, yes.
Well, as I understand it, in Colorado City, they're at least one of the breweries there, they're like, well, we're making pretty strong IPAs here.
Right.
You know?
Well, Colorado City's on the Arizona side.
Yeah.
So not bound by that particular law. And apparently, this is Ray Hammond's his name. He's the brewer at Edge of the World. And he apparently gets a lot of business from across state lines because a lot of Utahns who love beer can't get the more potent stuff on tap. So they come across and visit him. And
we should say for people who haven't been there, you can walk across the state line. There,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the line itself is just a street.
One thing I want to make sure we don't leave out here, Craig, is are there still any FLDS folks living in Short Creek?
Certainly. And I talked to Mayor Jessup, and she says, I would say maybe 1 in 200 people on the street now that you see walking the roads are wearing the uniform, you know, those traditional sort of prairie dresses. And she says that doesn't necessarily mean that 1 in 200 people are in the church. They could just be not dressing that way now. And but they don't have a way. She says there's no census that they can refer to. She just knows anecdotally that a lot of people left town.
Yeah. I mean, I have to imagine for Mayor Jessup in particular, and also Shem Fisher and some of these other folks that we've been talking about, that's got to be a really remarkable thing to know that this place where they were once the 1 in 200,
right,
you know, the apostates,
sure,
so to speak, they're now the ones running things.
Right. Yeah, it's a reversal of fortune, you know, a real unique Arizona story.
Well, Craig Gutier is the editor-in-chief at Phoenix Magazine and wrote this really fascinating piece about the rebranding of Colorado City. Craig, thank you so much.
Hey, Sam, appreciate it.
Well, if I've learned anything from the show today, it's that as time churns onward, it is hard to know what we will remember and what we will want to remember. So we hope this Wednesday edition of the program helped you make sense of some of your own memories or maybe identify some things you want to make sure you hold on to. Thank you for listening. We will be right back here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then.